clothing?
Marker, take five.
So, you were saying that, that coming from the way you were raised, it wasn't unusual for you to take such a leadership role. But...
No, because my mother was the dominant person in our family. You know, she had a restaurant, which she ran. It was her business. Then she had a hotel, which she ran. I mean, she's the one that gave the orders. And in CSO, she was very active, and she always won all the prizes, you know, for membership, for voter registration. I mean, she initiated a lot of projects in the community. So she was seen as a leader, and she always pushed me into doing things, you know. And, I mean, she always had me doing something. And unfortunately, I didn't get the other gifts that she had, which were her homemaking skills, right? Because she always had me out there doing things. So to me, it was a very natural role, I guess. It was not the usual traditional Mexican role. Also, my family was from New Mexico. You know, they had been there for many generations and very active in politics, etc. So it was kind of a different upbringing than what people think of as a traditional Mexican-American or Mexican upbringing.
But even saying that it was easy for you to do that way, that doesn't... those years from 62 to 65 were pretty difficult years, weren't they?
Well, they were difficult because...
Did you say they were difficult years?
They were very, personally, extremely difficult because, you know, I had seven children. I was a divorcee, and there was no money. And so it was, in that respect, it was very difficult. I mean, it was good because I knew what hunger was. I knew what it was to worry about what I was going to feed my children every day. You know, we literally had oatmeal and beans for months at a time. Helen's sisters, Teresa and Petra, would go get, you know, surplus commodities for both Cesar and myself, because we were like paying each other like about $30, $35 a week, and Cesar for his children, his eight kids, and me for my seven children. I knew what it was like to send my kids to school with shoes with that had holes in the rain. So it was a very, very hard time for us. But again, this is what farm worker families go through every day of their lives, you know. And knowing that, you know, it made it possible to survive those years when we were first organizing. And I remember when I made the decision that I was going to do it, the next morning somebody left a big box of groceries on my front porch in Stockton, and I thought that was just like a sign to me, you know. And I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to have, I didn't have a coat for that winter, and somebody gave me about five coats, so I had like coats to give away. But you know,
it's here, it's back.
I should have
rolling.
Take six.
Okay, we're continuing. We're almost getting up to 1965. When I was reading your letters at Wayne State, one period sometime between 62 and 65 when you were sick, you were in the hospital and had an operation.
Right.
And you wrote Helen and Cesar a letter apologizing for being sick, that you couldn't be out doing more and you were sick. Is that, what moved you to write a letter like that?
Well, I was supposed to be coming out to Delano in July, and then I got this... I got very, very sick, and they told me that I had to have a complete hysterectomy, which was then going to put me out of commission for another couple of months, right? And so, you know, I just felt that I felt really bad because I knew that Cesar was depending on me to come. We were going to start the newspaper. We're going to start other projects, I was organizing up in the northern part of the state, but we were getting members and what have you, and just, you know, keeping up with the membership was just getting, the administrative work was getting to be too much for Cesar. And so I just felt really bad that I wasn't going to be able to come and help, you know. Luckily, I never had that operation, and that's another story. But so I was able to come out after all. But at first I thought I wasn't going to be able to make it.
So by 1965, you were in Delano.
No, I came out in 64.
64.
Yeah. I had been organizing members for the union. And I was also doing the lobbying in Sacramento. That's why I was staying in Stockton. But I was, you know, having house meetings and organizing members in Stockton. My area was San Joaquin County, Stanislaus County, and Merced County. The three northern counties were my area. And Cesar was doing Kern, Tulare, and Fresno, and Kings County. Those were his He had five. We had eight.
A lot of territory.
Right. And so, you know, we would what we would do is we would go and leaflet, you know, in all the neighborhoods, you know. I would take my kids to leaflet, and Cece was doing the same thing with his kids. These were our crews, you know, the children. They were the ones that were doing the leafleting door to door about the union. Then we were also signing people up as members, and also putting out the material, right?
Mm-hmm. Now there's another letter. I think you wrote to Cesar at one point. You went to an AWOC meeting where they were taking a strike vote, and a woman came up to you afterwards and said, "I want to join the NFWA. You're the group that doesn't strike." So obviously you weren't thinking about going into a grape strike at that point.
Well, I was already in Delano when that happened. Yeah. Well, because of, as I mentioned to you before, that Larry and I had kept this relationship, you know, and always communicated with each other. No, so that when they were going to have, well, there had been a strike in the Coachella with the Filipino workers in the Coachella Valley, and they had gotten a wage increase. And so naturally when the workers came to Delano, then they wanted to do the same thing again. They wanted to have a strike. And so when they had their strike meeting, then Larry asked me to go to the strike. And in our plan that we did not want a strike. We wanted to organize a very large base. In fact, our plan was to organize the whole San Joaquin Valley before we ever had a strike, right? And so, you know, we were very concerned about what might happen if the Filipino workers went on strike. And since they had the crew leader organization that I mentioned earlier, right, they were all organized through the crew leaders. So basically it was going to be the crew leaders that were going to pull everybody out, all the Filipinos out. And we were concerned because we also were concerned that they would start the strike and then it wouldn't follow through on it, that it would be abandoned, right? And so we were very worried about what was going to be happening. The other thing is we had no money. We had like $70 in our treasury, I think, because the money that we used to collect in dues, half of that money had to go for an insurance program that we had. We collected, $350 a month, and half of the money went to pay for a death benefit insurance for the workers. And, we were also building up the credit union. We had the credit union already, which we had organized in 1963. So we were building a base based on and on services that we would give to the members and, the credit union and our dues base.
Well, looking back, it's clear that September of 1965 was a really historic moment. Mm-hmm. But did you have a sense then of how important it was going to be?
Oh, we knew. We knew it was going to be very important. It was going to be, first of all, it was going to...
Start that over and say, we knew the grape strike.
We knew that the grape strike was going to be a very decisive moment. But another thing, too, is that before we started the union, you know, we had carefully, you know, studied what had happened in the past. And what had happened in the past, of course, was that there were always strikes in the fields. And the workers would strike, and especially when outside organizers came in, and then they would leave, and the workers then would get blacklisted, and they would be left worse off than what they were before. So, you know, we didn't go into the organizing with the intention of trying to build a union through strikes, you know, because we already knew that had failed. This is why we were using a whole other approach, which was the community organizing approach that we had in CSO, is to build a strong base of workers through services and through the dues base and our credit union. And eventually the newspaper, El Macriado.
And then when the strike started, I guess you realized soon that it had to be a different kind of strike.
When the strike started, and it was, you know, all the workers came out, the strike started on September the 8th, and it lasted the whole week. And, of course, what happened is that the growers used such brutality against the Filipino workers, you know, by they shut out the lights in the bunkhouses, you know, they... shut off their gas, their lights. Some of them were even barricaded so they couldn't leave. And some of the Filipinos were beaten up, you know, and all these stories started coming out. And so then we knew that we had to support it. And then we had a big strike meeting. First, we had our own meeting, you know, to decide whether we would strike or not. And I always remember Helen. I always tell the story about Helen because when we got to Helen, of course, Cesar was worried about what she would think because of all the kids. And when he got to Helen, she said, "Well, what are we? Aren't we a union? You know, that's what we are. We're a union for, right?" And so there was no question. Of course, her sister Petra was working out in the fields, and Helen herself, you know, she was supporting the organization, especially their immediate family, by going out to work in the grapes every day. So she had a double job because she'd go out and work in the fields and have to come home and do, the housework and help with the union work also.
When we look at what happened in the grape strike, there were a couple of remarkable differences from normal strikes. And the first thing I'd like you to talk a little bit was how the teatro evolved and how the union decided to use culture and music and all those things?
Well, first of all, just going back to the grape strike, had the NFWA, the National Farm Workers Association, had we not joined in that strike, then it would have failed. I mean, because once that we came into the strike, then we just took over the leadership of the strike, you know, and we merged, you know, the two organizations. And of course, Al Green was very reluctant to do that at first, but he was kind of forced into it by, you know, I mean, he didn't want to do it, but, you know, he was finally forced into it. But the Filipino workers and us started working together almost immediately after the strike started. So, the idea of the culture and the songs and what have you. In fact, I was speaking at San Jose State, and Luis Valdez came up to me and he asked me, "Did I think that they would like to have a teatro in Delano?" And so I told him, well, I said, there's a caravan going down from San Jose State. I said, why don't you come on down, and then we can talk about it when you get down there, you know. So we got very excited about it. So when he came down, then we got some of the farm workers together, and they did an octo. And once they got it together, then I called Caesar over to come and see it. And, of course, he thought it was great. And so that was the birth of the Teatro Campesino, you know. But I'm the one that got Luis to come, so I always feel kind of good about that.
Yeah. Change. Uh-huh.
You know, we had another strike before the grape strike.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 22. And take 6, camera roll 23 is next, and take 7 is up.
Camera roll 10, take 7.
Well, let's switch gears again from the story of the strike to your role in it. In 1966, during the march, Caesar got a call from Shenley that they wanted to negotiate, and they were the first major grower to sign, and you all of a sudden became the union's first negotiator,
mm-hmm.
which was, again, an unusual role for you to play. You've never done negotiations before. Talk a little bit about what it meant to negotiate that first contract and how you went on to.
Well, I think that the reason that Caesar asked me to be the negotiator for the union is because I had also done all the legislative work. You know, I'm the one that did the lobbying to get pension for the non-citizens, disability insurance for farm workers, driver's licenses in Spanish. I had done all of that lobbying work for CSO and then also later on for the union. And so I think he felt that experience, I'm kind of judging what is why he made that decision to put me in charge of negotiations. And so what I did is right away I talked with all of the big labor leaders, like Lou Goldblatt from the Longshoremen's Union, other people from the Carpenters Union, people that I knew, and, you know, talked to them about what is negotiations, what do you do. I got copies of different labor union agreements and started, you know, picking out what I thought would apply to farm workers, and then started getting the farm workers together to, you know, so we could write the proposals. And so when we met with Shenley for the first negotiations, I had the contract completely written, and Cesar was surprised. He was shocked. Because he thought that the first meeting was going to be just like a, you know, get-together meeting. And Bill Kircher didn't want us to sign that first contract because it was the National Farm Workers Association. It was not, you know, AFL-CIO. But I already had the contract all written. And, you know, and Cesar was just, like, totally shocked, you know, that I had the contract already done. And the workers, you know, working together with the committee, we had already formulated the whole agreement. So when we met at that first meeting, I had the whole complete proposal to give them. And everybody was stunned that we had it ready. And that was really fun because we took the workers with us. We were also getting into the fight with DiGiorgio. And the first word out of Korshak, who was the person who had been assigned, Sidney Korshak had been assigned by Shenley to negotiate with us. He was a big shot labor fixer from Chicago. And he said, we've got DiGiorgio, you know. We want to wait until to see what happens with DiGiorgio before we sign a contract. And then one of the workers, Daniel Sanchez, said to him, "We don't work for DiGiorgio, we work for Shenley, you know, so we want you to negotiate with us." And the company representatives from the local area from Delano were extremely conservative, extremely negative. So what Korshak did is that he left them in one room, and we went over and negotiated the contract in another room. And so our first agreement was a recognition agreement, but it included the hiring hall, it included the wages, and some of the key provisions, you know. It was a very small recognition agreement with the time to negotiate the rest of the contract. And so this is what we started with. But it was, since I already had a contract written, I administered the first contract, I ran the hiring hall, and pretty much went out there and put into effect, implemented what I had written up as a contract, and eventually got the entire contract negotiated.
Well, part of when you read the accounts of grower farmworker negotiations, the accounts focus sometimes more on the style than the actual contract language. The fact that when farmworkers come to negotiate, they bring ranch committees. They bring, mm-hmm. That it's not one lawyer dealing with another lawyer. It was a different approach to negotiating, wasn't it?
Right, because we involved the workers from the very first step of writing the proposals, and our contracts were actually very good. They're, if you look at that very first contract that we had, I mean, we had extremely strong protections for the workers. In fact, we had protections for the workers in those contracts that we don't have today, in our later agreements. But the companies literally could not do anything without negotiating with the union. They couldn't subcontract. Workers got paid call time. Despite whatever the weather was, we had rest periods for the workers. I mean, a lot of things that we had in that contract. In fact, Phil Burton, when he was in Congress, told me that I got more in the first contract for farm workers than he had in all of his years as a legislator.
Now, you had had early experience in politics in terms of lobbying, and then you worked on negotiations of it. But later on, you moved back into the political arena. Talk a little bit about the 1968 elections and Bobby Kennedy and mm-hmm. what that meant to the union and you.
Well, in CSO, this is what CSO was. It was a civic action organization. So the first program that we did was to go do voter registration and then get out the vote, right? Although we did it on a nonpartisan basis, in CSO, we helped many Democrats get elected to office because we registered the people in the Spanish-speaking community and then got them out to vote. So all of that CSO experience really helped in terms of the union. And so when Bobby Kennedy was running in 68, and, first of all, when he came, when Cesar ended that first fast and he saw that everybody was saying Kennedy for president, he made the decision after being in Delano with all of those thousands of farm workers that he was going to run for the presidency. That's when he made his decision, right? And they had these plans where I was going to ride with Bobby Kennedy on the train as it was going through the valley, and Cesar was going to go and do all of these rallies all over the state of California in the Latino communities to start getting people committed to the campaign. But when Eugene McCarthy won in Oregon, then they changed all the plans, and Cesar went to Los Angeles to start setting up the precinct operation, and then I went and did all of the rallies. And a lot of us went to L.A. To set up precinct committees in all of the different areas and to get out the vote. And we did an incredible job,
Just the camera, the batteries, they've got it in. Mm-hmm. There's something funny. Mm-hmm. Is this anyone?
Mm-hmm. How could you tell? Could you hear?
What?
Could you hear it?
Roll in.
Marker, take 8.
CSO had been nonpartisan, but when the union was established and Kennedy came to the fast and made that connection, he became a very special person, didn't he? I mean, he met more than just a normal politician.
All right. Yeah. We all wanted to see Bobby win. So it was we were able to get the. We went to Los Angeles, to East LA. We did East Los Angeles and South Central LA, and even in the black community. And we would just go to people's homes and ask them to set up. If they would be willing to be the precinct captain. And once we got people committed to do that, we'd give them the precinct kits, and then we'd jump over to another precinct. So the idea was that we would try to set up so many precincts per day. And so we got the whole area covered, and it was an incredible vote, which, of course, gave Bobby the victory. Unfortunately, later on, we lost him because of that victory.
You were there the night of the primary at the, mm-hmm. at the Biltmore Hotel. Mm-hmm. What, describe that experience.
Well, when Bobby was going to come out to give his announcement, when it was obvious that he was winning, and which meant the presidency for him, right, because of all of our California votes that we had, then they came down to get Cesar and myself to go with the senator, but Cesar was not there because he had gone back to get Helen, and so I was, I went up to the room and to walk down with Bobby and Ethel, and the first thing that struck me is that he had no security, and because Cesar was always worried about Cesar's security, he only had like one person with him, and that kind of bothered me, but I didn't want to say anything because you know, how are you going to mar such a happy moment? And then as we were walking down, then they took us through the kitchen, and then he started to go over. People were waving to him, and he went over and started shaking hands with people. And I felt like saying, oh, don't do that. You know what I mean? Something said, don't do that. And but I didn't say anything. And he went and he started shaking hands with people. And then when we went up to the podium, after he was speaking, I was standing next to him. And as we started to come back, he was supposed to go to a room with us where we had mariachis waiting for him. That was, you know, immediately after his speech. But then someone came and said, no, Senator, go through here. And they took us back to the kitchen. And there was someone came in and pulled up their mics that were right there where he was speaking. I thought, my God, that could have been, you know, a bomb or something, you know, where he had been speaking. I had like these three distinct messages about his security. And as we turned around to walk back, then Jim Drake and Marshall were there. And he said, hey, the senator's supposed to come over here to the room. And I said, well, wait, I'll try to catch up with him. But, you know, because I had been walking right next to him. And as we tried to go back through there, I tried to catch up with him. But, you know, you had Rosie Geer, you had Steve Allen, you had all these, Mike Mazzucchi, you had all these big, giant guys. And I was trying to get up back next to the senator to make sure that after we got through the kitchen, we would go to the room where the mariachis were going to be. And, of course, I never got there because then, of course, he was killed.
So if he'd really gone to the mariachi room?
He wouldn't have gotten killed, probably, unless they had some other alternate plan to kill him. The one thing is that as we were walking towards the podium, through the kitchen, he said, you know, I really want to thank all of you for what you've done, you know, and he gave me this big old hug. He gave me a great big hug. And then I told him, well, you know, where Richard Chavez at precinct that he had worked, he had gotten 99% of the vote out. And then he said, oh, by the way, this is my wife, Ethel, you know, and then he turned around and introduced me to Ethel. So, you know, we were just very joyous as we were walking up to the podium.
That would have made a huge difference for the union as well as the whole country, wouldn't it?
I think for the whole world because of his, you know, affinity for Latin America, you know, the things that he had said that he would try to do if he became president.
But that connection was preserved. Ethel came out and helped later.
Yeah, we in fact, our first time that we met, first time I met Robert was when we had done our big voter registration drive in 1960 under CSO, and I had met Robert in San Diego. I was in charge of the voter registration drive there, so I had met him there before. And then I had met him in New York when, you know, we were trying to get him to come out for the fast, and he remembered me, which is really great. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, I remember you. And so he came, you know, we asked him to come out for the fast, which he did.
Out.
Mm-hmm.
Water?
Maybe a little bit.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 23, and that was take 8. And that's the end of the sound roll, too.
Rolling.
Roll 24, sound roll 11, take 9.
So let's talk about the stuff we were just talking about how intense that period was. About how things just kept on going from one thing to the next.
Yeah, once the Delano strike started, I mean, everything was extremely intense because you had picketing that started every morning, like at 4 o'clock in the morning, that went on all day, meetings that happened at night. Then, you know, we had that march to Sacramento. And, you know, everything had to keep going. Every single day there was there were things that were going on, people getting arrested. You know, some of the things were like the big mass arrest, the first mass arrest that we had of the women and the children. You know, people, you know, supporters coming down every Friday. There was a Friday night meeting that we had to prepare for. And, of course, the theater always had a new acto for the Friday night meetings. We were having picketing down in the produce market in Los Angeles, picketing in the produce terminal in San Francisco. People going off to the boycotts, you know, because so we got Shanley through a boycott. We had people hitchhiking to New York to do the first, to St. Louis and these other places to do the first boycott. The first boycotters went out with their thumbs, you know. They didn't have cars to drive. You know, the march to Sacramento. Then once we got the Shanley agreement, then we had started the big fight with DiGiorgio, and which ended up in I guess, the first secret ballot election for farm workers. And we had to, you know, bring in the American Arbitration Association, you know, the merger with the AFL-CIO, all, you know, we had the big fight with the Teamsters where they were beating people up, and you know, that's, and, oh, and then Census First Fast, you know, of course I was in 68, but all that first early, those first early days were just filled with an incredible amount of intensity, you know, going to San Francisco to pick up the DiGiorgio offices over there, people getting arrested in the DiGiorgio offices, having sit-ins. There was just an incredible, incredible amount of intensity that went on, you know, of work that was going on. So that every day was momentous. Every single day, there was just a lot of things that could happen during the course of a single day. In the meantime, also, we had another strike at Pearlie Minetti, another big fight with the Teamsters. Then we also had negotiations that went on with the wine companies. You know, we had DiGiorgio and, I mean, excuse me, Gala, the Gala Wine Company, the Novitiate, Francia, you know, we were the Palmasan, Almaden, all of these wine negotiations also went on during the period of, well, I guess that would be in period 66 to 68. So it was a very intense time for the union, for all of us that were in the union. We couldn't take any time off at all. I mean, you never even thought of taking a day off or even going to a movie or doing anything like that. There was just never any time for that because things were happening like every moment.
How did you keep up that pace?
I think it was, well, I mean, you had no choice. I mean, you know, you had no choice. You had to do it. You had to do it. Then I went off to the boycott in New York I guess it was in 68, you know, I went to run the boycott in New York City. And that's when we decided to boycott all table grapes because after the Jamara election, they started changing labels. And then I was in New York up until the time that, well, until we won, actually. I came back to New York and then did the boycott in the Bay Area. And then we had our big victory for the first grape boycott. Then in the meantime, we also had a big melon strike in Texas in 66. We had a strike up in Washington State in the hops, you know. So there was a lot of activity that was going on.
And a mixture of politics and everything else.
Yeah, we also got involved in a lot of political campaigns, you know. We had we helped Ron Dellums get elected in the Bay Area. And, you know, we got involved in other political campaigns. Although we didn't have any money, but we sent people there to go to do the work.
I want to go back to the Kennedys for a minute. One of Bobby Kennedy's earliest connections with the union was when he came out to do the hearings in 66.
Mm-hmm.
Was that an important event for the union?
Yes, it was. It was very important because, first of all, it was, you know, having a committee come out, which it was a national congressional committee. It also gave us that publicity that we needed because, you know, as the strike went on, people tended to forget that the strike was, you know, they tended to forget about it. And the contributions were not coming in as much as they had been before. So it was, and when Bobby came with that committee, it was very important for us because it was a national figure that had come to Delano. And then the day after, well, he was still here the day when we started our march to Sacramento, which was on March the 17th. Of 1966.
And was it clear that from then on that he was a friend of the union and would work with you?
Yes, we knew that he was a friend. Yeah. He also did some fundraisers for us in to raise money for the clinic.
Right.
For the clinic in Delano, the first clinic.
I know you just said it a minute ago, but the answer got sort of messed up. We were talking about what it would have meant if Kennedy hadn't been assassinated, what it would have meant for the union and the country.
Well, I think that when you look at all of what we've done for farm workers and the good that we've been able to accomplish for them, things that probably the growers or the government should have done, but the union, you know, we're the ones that initiated it and accomplished it. That if we would have had somebody friendly in the presidency, it would have made our task a lot easier.
Okay, let's move on to another big crisis period. the period in 72 and 73 when the contracts expired and that sense of being under siege again. It's like you've never won, right? There's always a new attack.
That's true because even in 1970 when we signed the contracts in Delano, the Teamsters, you know, had signed sweetheart contracts with the growers, and so we had the big vegetable strike that went on in 1970. And then, you know, those boycotts, when we started boycotting the lettuce, boycotting banana, I just lost my voice.
Okay. Can I stop for a minute? Yeah. Want
some water?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about a water?
Speed. Rolling.
Marker take 10.
I'd like you to talk about something else now, not about specific events or campaigns or those things, but about how you worked with Cesar, that you were the two strongest, most powerful people who influenced the shape and the growth of the union. What was that like working with him?
Well, I think Cesar and I thought a lot alike, you know, which made it, and I think we sort of fed on each other's ideas. I really liked working with him, especially when we were, clicking, you know what I mean? Because we could, you know, just, he'd come up with an idea, I'd come up with an idea, and it would go back and forth. It was just very exhilarating. And, I pretty much supported him in everything that he thought, and likewise, he did me. We differed a lot. I mean, I think our philosophies were very similar in things that we wanted to do and see done in the union. But we differed a lot was in tactics. And so we would have these really big fights about tactics, you know, and getting to some pretty big bad arguments about tactics. but then we would argue a lot, and it was kind of legendary. People that would hear us, you know, would think, oh, my God, you know. and then afterwards, you know, it would be as if we'd never fought at all. And we just, you know, get back into the group and start working again.
Was that part of the work process of how you...
Well, I remember once when he did his first fast, because I had been in New York, you know, organizing the Great Boycott. You know, Cesar was disabled for a whole year after the Kennedy campaign, because he went to work, do the campaign for Bobby, and he had just had his 25-day fast, and he didn't rest. So he was in for a whole year up until from August of 68 until, August of 69. He was, like, bedridden with excruciating cramps. And during the time during his fast, I told him, you know, Cesar, I really feel, here he was fasting, and we all felt terrible when we heard about his fasting, you know, that he was doing this fast. And I told him, yeah, I really feel awful because I fight with you so much. And he told me, don't ever stop. He said, don't ever stop fighting with me. He said, I need you to fight with me. So it was like, you know, I was feeling guilty because here he was fasting. And of course, I couldn't fight with him when he was fasting, you know. But so it was good. You know, we would have some really big disagreements. And kind of the way after we got to the point that when I was given an assignment, you know, I would just do it. And, you know, and then sometimes that would bother him, too, because, I wouldn't check in with him until I got the assignment done. It's just like with the negotiations, right? He assigned negotiations, so I went out and got the whole proposal written, right? And he was shocked that I did it. But, he pretty much... I just felt that as long as I was operating within the what our Constitution dictated and what our goals were, that I didn't have to check with him, you know, every few minutes or whatever, which is different than the way other people in the union worked with him. I initiated a lot of the ideas of the union. We had a big fight about whether we should have a grape boycott or potato boycott. He wanted to have a potato boycott. And we thought we should have a grape boycott, you know, both Fred and I. And so we can talk to Cesar on the phone and said, no, it's got to be a grape boycott, Cesar. He was worried because we had a contract with DiGiorgio. So we put in very small print, boycott California grapes except DiGiorgio, right? And that's how we got around that one. But sometimes when I would come up with an idea at the beginning, he would, you know, he would have to think about it, whether he thought it was good or not. And sometimes, we'd have to change tactics in the middle of the stream, and I'd say, no, Cesar, we've got to do it this other way, you know. But we worked very well together. I enjoyed working with Cesar. You know, he was a very creative person, and he had Cesar's ideas, because, you know, he didn't have a formal education, you know, so he didn't get his ideas were fresh, you know. They were, you know, sometimes because of our school systems that we have, you know, the thinking process is sort of smashed, or it's not encouraged, right? And Cesar had just a very open way of thinking about things, you know. So.
Oops, we're out already. Gosh, we're going out faster.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 24 and take 10. Camera roll 25 will be next, and we'll be starting with take 11.
Camera roll 25, sound roll 11, take 11. Marker.
Tell me a little more about how you worked with Cesar. You said once something about, well, Cesar was the president of the union, so he had to act a certain way, but that you had more liberty because you didn't have to act like a president. Tell me about that. You know, that you could go off and be as tough as you wanted on the growers and then he couldn't do that because he had to, you know, be diplomatic.
Yeah, well, I guess being a vice president, you always have a lot more liberty. And I guess being a woman, too, I mean, I could probably get away with things that it would have been more difficult, you know, for Cesar to do. One of the things that I think that also has to be talked about Cesar is about his spiritual force and how he created that. I mean, just not just the idea of fasting, but, you know, the idea that the march to Sacramento, right? The fasting that he did, but also had people in the union do. You know, like when our martyrs were killed, we fasted for 3 days. Having masses before every important occasion. So he brought a very strong spiritual force into the organization, you know, the nonviolence, and making that like the cornerstone of the organization. And that is something that I think is like very, very unique. And, you know, Cesar meditated. He really believed in caring for animals. You know, the way his attitude was towards his dogs, is really. And he always said that the best kind of an education that anybody could have was to be a good human being. Ser gente, you know, to be conscious of other people. That was the most important thing, and to be responsible, you know, to be a responsible human being, the discipline. Which I think are the things that kind of make UFW, United Farm Workers, different than other organizations, you know, because you do have that spiritual force, the idea that of working without the volunteerism, that you work without wages, and that you have enough faith in yourself and in God that somehow you're going to make it, even though you don't get paid, you know, you're going to eat. And just the whole idea of even starting the union, you know, something that every other, well, several major unions had attempted to do, including powerful unions like the Teamsters, the Laborers, others, and had never been able to do that. But that incredible faith that Cesar had in himself, right? The other thing is that he never gave the face of defeat or the face of discouragement. I don't care how bad things were. You know, he always had that very positive outlook because he knew that whatever he was showing is what, you know, that was what the organization would feel. And that was that incredible, incredible strength that he had, incredible strength. And his strength, I think, gave everybody else a lot of strength.
Where do you think he got that strength?
I think he got it from his mother, Juana Chavez, an extremely strong woman, from his father, Librado. But, I mean, because, you know, when you think of all of the things that they went through, and again, those strong cultural values, you know, very strong cultural values. And to Cesar, the most important things to Cesar were his immediate family, Helen and the kids, and the union. And other things, and every other thing, you know, was secondary to him. That was number one.
Obviously, your family and his family were very close, and your lives were entwined for 30 years. What did you go through? What did you feel when you heard that he had died?
Well, I guess I was like everyone else. I was shocked, and he had been acting so different, you know. Before he passed away, those 6 weeks that we were working together before he died, we had been here at La Paz, we had been in Yuma, and it was very different because, you know, as I said before, Cesar and I would fight about almost everything. Sometimes I used to tell Cesar, you like to fight with me because you know that you can get away with it, right? You know what I mean? And you know that I'm still here because sometimes he would just fight just to fight, Pelionero. But those 6 weeks before he passed away, you know, we didn't have a single fight. It was very, he was just acting so, and I had told, yeah, I had even told Richard before, I said, you know, it looks like Cesar's preparing for his mortality. Because before he would not let us have, you know, we put a button with his picture on it when he was in jail in Salinas. And then he got very upset about that. He didn't want anything with his picture on it. And then, of course, later on we talked him into doing a picture with him and his grandson in it. But he didn't like that. He didn't like stuff with this. And then and he had allowed a curriculum to be made, you know, about him, to be sent out to the schools. So it was a big shock. Excuse me. It was a big shock, you know, when he died. And I guess my first feeling was one of you know, what will happen to the union, right? Like everybody else thought. But I just, you know, knew that somehow, you know, the union was going to make it, just because of all of the discipline and the teachings and the trainings that the union staff had gone through. And he always gave people a lot of responsibility and a lot of freedom to do the work that they had to do. So people had already been trained. And I knew that we would make it.
Well, things are looking good now. There has been a rebirth.
And I think that the other thing is that people didn't understand what Caesar was doing. When you talk about a rebirth, see, what Caesar was doing in his last years is he was building the foundation. He was developing the associate membership program, you know, which would lay out a foundation so that workers could join the union without being under a union contract. And, you know, it took him time to do that, to develop those programs and to get the kinks out of them. And so people thought, well, he should be running around the fields with a flag in his hand, right? We had elections covering 7,000 workers between 89 and 91. And we beat the Teamsters and the Painters in about five or six other elections. So all of this was going on that people weren't aware of, because we, you know, we got no press. We didn't get the election certified. And so people thought that Caesar wasn't organizing. I think what happened after Caesar passed away is that it was such a big shock for everyone, you know, including the ALRB, the politicians, everybody, that people felt, you know, Caesar's message about people being responsible had got out in a very big way with his passing, because then people felt, you know, I should be doing more. And so people started doing more.
So it sort of woke them up.
It was like a wake-up call, because one young woman who's now our director in Washington State, the day that Caesar passed away, or the day after, you know, when she heard about it, she went and she told her husband and her family, I'm quitting my job. She worked for the bank, and I'm going to work full-time for the union. But a lot of people felt that way. Now, I think that's a phenomenon that we saw, that people just felt that now Caesar wasn't there. You know, people always felt, well, sure, farm workers have problems, but Caesar's there. He's going to take care of them. Once Caesar passed away, people knew, hey, wait a minute, I've got to do more. Caesar was always asking people to help. Please do this. Please do that. Like with his last fast, you know, his last 36-day fast, he wanted people to help more on the pesticides. And so everybody knew that they had to do more. And I think that's what we've seen.
Because there's always a tendency when movements have strong leaders, mm-hmm. to think that they're completely dependent on those leaders.
Or completely self-sufficient, to put it that way. That somehow, you know, that leader's going to be strong enough to be able to do all that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there had been a lot of, you know, a bad mouthing or denigrating of Caesar before he passed away, even by former people who had formerly worked for the union.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about how the union has sort of changed America, how it's affected the way people live and think, and what it's contributed to making America better.
Well, the union is a real inspiration. I mean, first of all, the message that you can have a leader like Caesar. He only went to the 8th grade, you know, who had really nothing to support him, but was able to literally from the ground organize a union for farm workers, something that was in everybody's books an impossible, including Solitsky, an impossible task that couldn't be done. And the fact that people are willing to work for others, you know, without wages, you know, and people are willing to come out on strike, go on boycotts, go to jail, and all of this, you know, and continue in spite of the fact that people have been killed, like the martyrs that have been killed, you know, Rufino Contreras, René López, Nan Friedman, Najid Aifala, Juan de la Cruz, that people are still going to continue. I mean, and when people see this, I mean, it's just the workers are, I mean, just the work itself and the people, the staff of the union are an inspiration for people to see. And we still see this happening. You know, one of the things, when you talked about Fred Ross, you know, he's really like the father of the movement in many ways, because he, you know, he's the one that got organized CSO initially, that got elected Congressman Roybal, you know, got Caesar into organizing, got me into organizing. He was the one that taught our the people in the union the house meeting approach, right? To continue that, to teach a lot of people how to organize to continue, and part of that was the discipline and getting the responsibility. That is what Fred stressed, and that's what Cesar stressed, and that's what makes the union strong. And so you see that when people come out, leave our organization and go to work for other unions, they're always impressed because of the discipline and the hard work, and the people are willing to go to great lengths to help other people.
Do you think the union has affected politics too? Has it changed the way minorities participate in politics?
Well, we know for a fact it's changed the Latino community, you know. I mean, you know, because we were the first ones out there that were doing voter registration, you know, get out the vote. And a lot of people have learned through the process, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the end of camera roll 25, intake 11, and that's the end of the sound roll. I'm changing sound rolls.
All right.